This week's speaker is Bernard Helle from the University of Washington in Seattle. Bernard got his PhD from UCLA and spent some time at Stanford before moving to the University of Washington, where he is at the Quaternary Research Center and the Earth and Space Science Department. He has a PhD in geology, but what he's interested in is the physics of icy landscapes, which seems appropriate to our coming to Toronto from Seattle. So today he's going to tell us about icy dirt. Bernard.
Thank you very much. Oh, I see I have a pointer. Can you all hear me okay? I hear myself very well here, but I have a question. I understand I have quite a diverse audience, so I have a couple of questions for the audience here. How many people know that ice is slippery? Come on, I want to see hands up. This is my test of the activation barrier here. How many people think they understand why ice is slippery? Okay, so we have a conservative audience in terms of what they know. Okay, how many people think that have heard this idea that because of the pressure underfoot or under an ice skate, you have this lowering of the melting point, and you can actually form a melt layer that allows you to maintain the slipperiness? How many people believe this is what's happening? Okay, so I see actually a greater number of people actually have a confidence in this mechanism than actually talked about, saying that they claim they understood the process. Another common mechanism is that, this is a little bit more exotic, is that when you're ice skating, for example, you're dissipating a lot of heat underfoot because you're doing a lot of work, and that's concentrated in a small area, so there is a lot of work, and the heat of dissipation is sufficient to temporarily melt a layer of water. How many people believe that this is what's happening? We have probably non-ice skaters who are probably going to raise their hands, okay? So we have a couple. Okay, and it turns out that neither of those mechanisms really works, and also the reason it's slippery is because there is an unfrozen water film that remains at down to very low temperature on the surface of ice, and that particular property of ice and water is also something that's really very important for understanding some of the patterns that I will show you, and I hope to make that link with you shortly. So, first of all, let me thank Stephen there for having me here, and it's a pleasure to address this somewhat reactive audience here. Also, let me start off by thanking a few folks who were very important in contributing to this work here, and I'm failing one other test here of how this works.
They make the button black.
Oh, I see. Very good. Okay, great. Okay. I've had the good fortune to work with a lot of very good people. Link Washburn is the person who got me really inspired in thinking about pattern ground in frozen ground areas, and he brought me to Washington. Ron Sletten I work with closely, Suzanne Anderson was a student of mine, and Ray Fletcher is a colleague that goes back to Stanford days, and we've had many decades of working together on this. In terms of instrumentation, I had the good fortune of working with Chris Doves, who now is on the faculty at Harvard in physics, but he had a stint in our lab and helped us develop some of the instrumentation that you'll hear about later on. And Carrington Grecki was working with him on this. In terms of modeling, I've had the good fortune of working with Brad Werner, also a background in physics, who's now at Scripps Institute of Oceanography. He worked with Mark Kessler and Brad Murray. They came out in the field and looked at some of the features that I will show you. And Mike Mellon has also worked with us, and he's very interested in kind of the patterns and their equivalent patterns on Mars. I'd like to dedicate this to Link Washburn. I mentioned to you that this field certainly got me interested in this and has made a tremendous sort of a contribution to this field. But also I'm sad to say that he just passed away like 2 days ago, just before I came here. And he led a very long and rich life. He was 96 or so when he passed away. And so no regrets there, but it's just sad to see somebody of that stature and that sort of immense personal character that he had that actually leave us. So I'm going to dedicate this to him. And I'd just like to point out that if you'd like to follow up on any of this, the starting place would be geocryology one of the books written by Link Washburn. Okay, patterns. You've probably heard about patterns in nature in various ways, but I mean, to me, the patterns are, you know, they're aesthetically very pleasing, they're striking, and also they're quite unusual. I mean, the fact that you actually notice a pattern is partly the fact that it's an extraordinary thing, is that nature usually doesn't have these kinds of patterns. But I would like to argue that, you know, they're fantastic, you know, in terms of focusing your research interests and trying to really address what are the processes that together sort of operate to give rise to this spatial sort of expression of the underlying physics. These are ripples of sand at Eureka Dunes. This is just north of Death Valley. And this striking order emerges from two very random things. One of them is wind blowing over the surface, and the turbulent flow of air over the surface is inherently structureless. I mean, it has all kinds of link scales. And also, the other important thing here is that as a wind gets to be high enough velocity, it's mobilizing particles that bombard the surface more or less at random. And so that's another very random process. And yet, out of those two seemingly random processes, you develop this really striking order. And at this point, I think there's enough work done, mostly by Brad Werner and Bob Anderson and others, to really understand the two-dimensional intricacies of this pattern. So this is an example of patterns in nature. And before I get on to the real meat of this talk here, I just want to give you a little roadmap. And what I'd like to do is largely illustrate the kind of diversity of patterns that we have in nature, in the high Arctic and sometimes in the Antarctic, and talk about essentially two categories. One is primarily associated with contraction cracking, and what happens to a half space essentially as you cool it. And you develop tension parallel to the surface, and then you crack that surface and it evolves. And the length scale for that is typically 10 or 20 meters, and I'll illustrate this. And this contraction cracking could happen with or without ice. That's not something that really is requiring ice. But on the other hand, there's a whole other suite of patterns that where the formation of ice in the soil in various forms is critical, and is critical to the development of the microtopography on the scale of 2 to 4 meters, and about, there's another set of patterns that forms on a scale of about a decimeter. I hope to give you some insights about the processes and the feedbacks that underlie this kind of self-organized expression of these features. Okay, one pattern are the sort of patterns here of polygons. This is taken from a helicopter, and typically these are sort of 10 to 20 meters or so across. This happens to be in the dry valleys of Antarctica. And the patterns are outlined because the cracks underlie small troughs in the surface, and they're full of snow, so you're seeing that. And this is looking down at a surface like this. Once again, for example, this is one pattern that we've got a little met station there, and we have, this is a pattern that's like 10 meters across. And in that case, the patterns are defined by cracks and troughs along the sides, and there's along each trough, there's also a double ridge that is on either side of that crest. And notice here, though, that there's quite a bit of complexity in the patterns. Here you have sort of flat domains, you know, bordered by these cracks. And here you have smaller domains that have that are more irregular in the center. And we have no idea really about why you have that kind of variation over a surface that was probably fairly uniform. Many of the elements of this have been known for a very long time. For example, these polygons that I've just talked to you about are quite common in the Arctic. They're called ice wedge polygons in the Arctic. And this is the idea is fairly simple, is that in the initial state, you're freezing the ground. Once the ground is completely frozen, then the temperature drops another 10 or 20 degrees. Okay? And it may remain low for like, you know, several weeks. And so you develop tension parallel to the surface, which cracks the surface, because if the tension exceeds the strength of the material, it will crack. As soon as it cracks, of course, it releases the stresses near the crack. And then during the following warm season here in the permafrost areas, for example, in the far north in this part of the world, the surface, the upper half a meter to a meter or so, will thaw. And so you liberate water, and the water can dribble down into these open cracks, and it freezes. And then, of course, during a subsequent year, then, you know, where you had this ice injected, it doesn't quite heal the cracks, so the crack is likely to reform there, and so you form more ice there. And eventually, you do this time and again, you end up with a wedge of ice. And the wedge of ice now doesn't allow the ground to swell back and to close a crack. So you have to shoulder aside the material on both sides. And so you end up with a trough and two ridges. Okay? And also you see the displacement of the material there. As you're shouldering the material, that propagates down to some depth. This is a view in the Alaskan Arctic showing this ice. And the same thing happens if you don't have water, like in the dry valleys of Antarctica. You have sand that dribbles down into these cracks, and that prevents a closure. But then after a while, you get what we call a wedge of sand. So those will be called sand wedge polygons. To get a feeling of what's happening there, we can measure the temperature. And this is a temperature measured, for example, at 4 meters. You're measuring the temperature here. The cycle of temperature is just like, you know, not quite 10 degrees there. The air temperature might cycle through about 50 degrees. By 4 meters, you've already damped that sort of seasonal signal that much. And by the time you're down at about 19 meters, you don't hardly see that. So all the thermal contraction and expansion is occurring basically in the upper 10 meters. Okay? And not surprisingly, the scaling of these polygons is a small multiple of that 10 meters. I mean, there's a simple connection there. What we can do, and these are measurements that were done by Ron Sletten, and now he has like 6 years of these measurements. You can measure here the temperature. This is actually the air temperature. And what you're seeing here is a measurement across two polygons, across one of these cracks. And as you can imagine, that when the cracks or when the polygons are shrinking, the cracks are opening. Okay, and what you're seeing here is that indeed we get an opening of about a centimeter during the winter. And you can see that this doesn't have all the high frequencies that you have in the air. So that gives you an idea of at what depth, you know, is the soil mostly contracting and actually expanding. So basically, the picture you should see of this is that, you know, seasonally you have the opening and the closure of cracks of about a centimeter. So it's not surprising that sand falls down in those cracks, but then coarse material stays at the surface. So that's one way of ending up with a surface that has a lot of rocks at the surface and lots of sand down below. Okay. And in detail, you get this kind of interesting sort of morphology. This was drawn by Troy Payway, a geologist who did some early work in this area. Very nice observations. This shows the deformation of the soil, uplift of the margins, and then this is that wedge of sand that is essentially devoid of any large clast or cobbles that would have gone down into the crack. So another view of this is shown here, where you have largely, in this case, pretty orthorhombic sort of or squarish patterns. But what I want to draw your attention to are these long troughs that form. And the troughs here are bordered by identical ridges. Okay, and I've talked about why that is. I mean, you have to shoulder aside the material that corresponds to the extra material that the volume of the wedge. And I want to suggest to you that there may be a parallelism. If you look at Europa, now we're jumping planets now. We'll do that a couple of times before we come back to the Earth. But one of the striking features on Europa is that you get all of these crack-like patterns, all these lines, and they're known to be cracks. But one of the interesting, outstanding problems, as I understand it, is the topography of these, that the cracks are very distinct, but so are the ridges. The ridges are identical in size, and they border the crack very regularly. And one way to do that is to do something very similar to what happens in our polygons, is that supposing you have the crack here and water would actually flow into the crack, it would flow up to the level of buoyancy, and then it would freeze there. It would freeze there quickly. So that would prevent the closure of the crack there. So eventually the crack would try to close, and it would shoulder aside this right here. And you can imagine that the length scale, the A and B, would scale with this sort of depth or this level of buoyancy. And so there may be some information there about the thickness of the ice cover on Europa that would sort of come out of the same physics of inhibiting a crack closure by capping it at the surface. Okay, so jumping back now, this is a very icy planet. A less icy planet, Mars, has all kinds of interesting features that I hope you'll see resemble some of the features I've just talked about. Like, for example, these are polygons that are quite large. This is 300 meters. So we have some polygons that are like maybe 40, 50 meters across, but some of these are up to like 200 meters across. And we don't quite have an analog for that on Earth. The largest polygons I've seen are approach about 100 meters. But so this is actually a very interesting sort of pattern. But there are other patterns on Mars that are interesting. This is a view that I got from Mike Millen, by the way. And you get also these kind of moundish patterns that come out here between these big dunes. These are sand dunes. But so you have mound-like patterns. Then you also have stripe-like patterns that develop. And so I want to show you, you know, examples of those features that we see in cold regions on Earth. So going back to Earth here, let me take you to the Scandinavian Arctic. This is near the sort of north, sort of west corner of Spitsbergen. And here, these surfaces here are beaches that were underwater probably about 18,000 years ago. Okay, and they were when the whole area was depressed by the weight of the ice. And then as the ice bodies in this case, the ice sheets and the glaciers retreated, this came up and sort of became emergent. And my point here is that the initial condition for this is pretty well known. We start off essentially with old beaches, and so we expect to see sand and gravel and some silt, but mostly fairly coarse material. Okay, and the amazing thing is that in just like barely 10,000 years or more, this surface transforms to this. So you develop, this striking sort of order here. These are circles of stone, typically 3 or 4 meters across. The permafrost here is like 150 meters deep. The permafrost thaws to about 1.5 meters, maybe up to 2 meters or so. So once again, in this case, the length scale is sort of consistent. It's a small multiple of the depth scale where the activity is. So you can expect that in an area that is wet and exposed to freezing condition, the soil will freeze and will swell due to that freezing seasonally down to a depth of about 1.5 meters. And so this length scale, though, is something that's quite characteristic of these. We call these stone circles or sorted circles, and sorting to geology means sort of segregating material according to size. And so what defines these is that they have borders of gravel, and the inner material is finer grain material. It just looks dark on these pictures. So let me sort of take you through this. The circles are there. We've known they're there for a century. There were geological excursions that were taken from Oslo up to this side because the circles were so prominent. We knew they had to do with freezing, but that's about it. I mean, lots of observations, lots of clever people looking at things in the summer. But basically, no one had the instruments until a couple decades ago to actually measure what was happening in the soil when it was snow-covered. And so a lot of the action in terms of what happens during the freezing and thawing have not been clear until we could actually put out instrumentation. To understand the sorted circles, we have to understand the sorting of material. Why is it sorting at all? We have to understand frost heaving in some detail. We have to understand kind of the active layer, what defines a depth of 1.5 meters, and how it might vary spatially. Then we get more fundamental. We have to understand why is it that soil actually expands when it freezes. Let me ask you another question. How many people think they understand? No, this is kind of a trick question. Okay, how many people think that, for example, this soils would not expand if there was not a difference in density between ice and water? Okay, it's also a trick question, right? I mean, it turns out that I think most of you, if I'd ask in a slightly more clever way, would have said that, look, it's knowing that water expands by 9% to form ice, there has to be some expansion. And that's correct. But it turns out soils expand much more than that. And the expansion is due largely to actually the advection of water to freezing sites and then the formation of ice that way. So the ice lensing phenomenon is a rich phenomenon in itself. And this is consistent, you know, not only with sort of freezing in soils, but also in rocks. And then when you get to it, you really have to understand these liquid-like films. Yeah?
So does this happen in systems that are not
water-based? Yes. Actually, the frost heaving has been demonstrated in materials that actually shrink upon freezing. And this was done, and I'll show you an experiment that was done by the individual who first showed this. Yeah, in fact, this is... A fellow by the name of Tabor was a geologist interested in quartz veins, like in the Sierra Nevada, in granites. And his question was, well, did the quartz kind of fill up an open gap, or did the quartz help form that gap? And so to understand that, he actually set up, this is Stephen Tabor, he set up these experiments of freezing clay, and he actually did some experiments with some organic constituent that actually contracted upon freezing and showed that the whole thing heaved. But this is basically, this is a phenomenon here, is that without the initial materials like this, and without any ice lenses, I mean, that's what it would look like. But here you have now formed a lens of ice that's like 100 to 1,000 times thicker than the grain size or the pore size. So clearly you've displaced material. You've actually had to bring in lots of water from nearby. And let me show you what happens now when you freeze. And this is an experiment. I hope I can get it running for you. Okay. What this is a freezing from the surface, an experiment that took about 4.5 days. You're cooling from the surface, and the freezing front is right there. You can see the tremendous inflation of the soil due to the freezing, much more than this 9% of the pore space. This is a rock that was painted red, so you can see what happens to the rock in this material. So now you're forming a gap over the top of the rock. The rock is not moving relative to the base yet. And I'll show you now, at this point now, the freezing front is going like this. Now the rock is coupled to this frozen ground, and it will start to move up with that material. Okay? And so our little clock is spinning around here, and we're forming more and more ice here.
There's no air pockets in there, it's all
ice. It's all ice. Everything that looks translucent is ice. Okay? And basically what happens here is that, I mean, you get this tremendous influx of water that comes in from the base, and this is fed from a base that's kept above freezing, and this ice will grow indefinitely. So the heaving is simply is a function of just the transport of water to the freezing front. It has really essentially nothing to do with the volumetric increase due to 9%. And as I say, Stephen Tabor realized this and was able to demonstrate that with this organic material that actually contracted about freezing. So our tendency to assume that we understand why soils, let's say, expand upon freezing is somewhat misleading. But the reason I show this is that this shows how the sorting happens. This happens during 4.5 days. It's not unreasonable that in nature it's very similar to this. I think this rock actually moved up several centimeters in those 7.5 days. I should have shown you that there's actually a ruler on the side here that moves up with this experiment. But you can imagine when this thaws, it will thaw from the surface down. So as it thaws, you convert the ice to water. The water will permeate through the soil and eventually sort of leave at the surface or nearby. And so the consolidation will happen. This hole here at the top really has very little consequence because it just fills in from the top. Okay? But now, one thing that's not so obvious is this, is that as all of this settles then, the stone here will not necessarily fall down all the way down again, because some of this material here will ravel into the space here, or probably did as the stone was brought up. Because as the stone was pulled up, there was still unfrozen material down below, so there was a bit of sagging in of the soil around. So the bottom line is that this is in detail kind of a slow motion view of kinetic sieving, where material goes up, big stones go up, and they can't come back down because little things get in the way. So if you do this repeatedly, what happens is that the stone moves right up to the surface. So, and the stones emerge at the surface in the springtime, because that's when, you know, the stone actually moves up during the winter, but the soil also moves up during the winter. And then during the springtime, the soil settles preferentially, and so the farmers are able to see these stones emerging out of their fields. They have to clear their fields seasonally. So this is really important for understanding the process. So going back to these circles, we've got these are sort of 3 meters. Fairly temperate region is surrounded by ocean water, so although it's very high latitude, 79 degrees. 89 would be pretty much up there. But it's still fairly temperate. The mean annual temperature here is only about -5 degrees. So you're very close to that sort of area of interest where there is a lot of freezing, there's a lot of unfrozen water in the frozen ground. And I want to point out that in ideal circumstances, this process gives rise to perfect circles. I mean, I would dare any of you with enough patience to try to form a circle out of gravel. They would actually be, you know, better formed than these features. So somehow nature when everything is as ideal as possible, as uniform as possible, it's able to create this incredible sort of symmetry. And some details that give you clues about what's going on. If you just look at it, this is material that's extremely soupy. Like if you, I mean, these are my footprints. I walked in there. You just sink into your kneecaps in this material. So it's material that should just empty the area. But what you find is that instead of that muddy material moving into the stone, there's a very distinct boundary. You also see a little bit of a ridge here. And what that is a little fold that forms at the edge. And it's a little fold of algae that forms on the surface. And what it represents is an area where you have compression. And this is actually a little surface fold of the surface, which indicates that this material here is moving radially outward towards that material, and yet it's not invading that material. Okay, so that's one little clue that you can get without any measurements. If you make some excavations, you can get a lot more information. You find that there's organic material on the surface, and that organic material goes down like this. So you kind of have a subduction of this material under the coarse material here. And same thing on that side, although it's not as apparent. And then on some of these, you can see in the middle of the border, there's actually an ascent of material that used to be at depth. So there's a lot of vertical motion in something like this. And basically, I mean, this is not a good slide for this, but what you can infer from observations and also from simple experiments, and I'm not talking about high-tech stuff, I'm talking about putting toothpicks in the soil and measuring them year after year with a tape. What you find is that you have radial motion away from the center that's at about a centimeter a year, so it's very easy to measure. And then what I just talked about, the subduction here, that this fine-grained material goes down, and then there is also this divergence of material here at the summits. Another version of this is probably more accurate, is shown here. And I'll show you some measurements. We have some measurements of rotation that we've done instrumentally that actually show this. So by putting at first toothpicks and then getting a little more sophisticated with getting toothpicks that would not move out of the soil, because toothpicks we found didn't last in the soil more than a couple of seasons, they were heaved out. What you find is this is kind of this messy data, but that basically the displacement was proportional to the slope. And that's not surprising. As soon as you have a slope, although we're talking about microtopography, material will move downhill. So this shows kind of an honest sort of report of the data. It's very noisy data, and you can imagine some cobbles will be moving different ways, etc. And so some of these are painted cobbles, some of these are toothpicks. But basically, the interesting thing is that you can assume what your intuition would tell you, is that wherever there's a slope, material is moving down that slope. And so which means that the topography should diffuse out through time, unless it's dynamically maintained in some way. Okay, so that's important. So you expect that because the topographic gradient drives the slope, the motion, you expect a diffusive relaxation of the surface that would be quite fast because we're able to measure this sort of centimeter motion. And yet we find that in detail, the topography does not disappear. Okay, so I'll get back to that. But our tack has been to say, well, look, what's really been missing in this field is actually trying to just measure what's going on, because we see beautiful expressions of something, but we're not really defining, let's say, the properties. And so because it's manageable, we're talking about a few meters, we can put out instruments. Like these set of heave sensors, these are just displacement transducers to measure vertical motion of the soil. So we can measure, you know, during the freeze-up, it will come up, etc. These are pore pressure transducers, because we know whenever you're dealing with frictional material, you'd like to understand the pore pressure and the effective pressure, because that dictates frictional resistance to motion. And then all of the T's are tilt sensors. These are biaxial tilt sensors that allow us to look at rotation of the motion. They also contain thermistors, so we know if this is moving while it's frozen. Okay. And let me just kind of give you an idea. I mean, these are pretty low-tech things. We put these biaxial transducers inside of PVC tubes. We glue some stones on the outside so they're well coupled to the soil, so they'll rotate with the soil. And just let me give you I could show you lots of data, but let me just concentrate on this. This is one transducer here on the side of the border. And what I'm showing you here is that we expected it to rotate in this sort of direction. And what is seen here is that the blue is the temperature of the transducer. So the temperature was like -3, goes up to freezing, and then here it's thawed out. and the temperature goes up to just a few degrees, and that's what happens there in that soil, and then it freezes again over here. In terms of the tilt, you're looking at the black line. The tilt, it tilts by about, from about 2 to minus 3, so it tilts 5 degrees during just the first couple of weeks of thawing, okay? And this tilt there is essentially a clockwise rotation. It's a clockwise rotation. So this transducer rotates clockwise by about 5 degrees during a period of 2 weeks or so. And during that period, what's happening here is that the soil inside of this domain somehow thaws a lot more rapidly than this soil, which is exactly the opposite of what I would have predicted, because I knew there would be a lot more ice and heaving here, and yet it thawed out a lot more quickly. I would have thought that the latent heat would actually buffer that. But anyway, so during a single season, then this particular sensor does this, and then there is something fairly complicated here that happens, but basically during the freeze-up, it goes back closer to its initial state. Okay, so this tilt sensor is ratcheting. I mean, during a single season, it goes one way and then comes back. And you might expect that, because we expect the soil to go up and down. Okay, but these were very difficult data to get and to actually maintain early, or early loggers would always fail during the winter and stuff. So, and then we'd go in the summer and fix them, and so we'd have good data during this period, and then we'd have fairly lousy or fairly sporadic data during the rest of the season. So what I can show you is a compilation of data taken during essentially consecutive winters. Okay, you'd expect them to all be the same, and indeed, they're pretty similar. The first one I showed you was here, and then second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year. And so what you're seeing here is basically the signal, but this ramping here means that there's about a 1 degree hysteresis per year. And so what we're looking at is that we're looking at a cycling time of about, you know, 1 degree per year would give you sort of 360 years, right, for a full cycle. And so this is the kind of impression that we get. But because we have the data in some detail, we can start to understand better what is it that's actually causing this rotation. Okay? This is a topography. I told you that the topography is very distinct here, and it's sustained. And here are measurements taken, like, let's say, over a 12-year period. And you can see you have high ridges of gravel, and then this is the fine grain material. And these are just measurements taken over exactly the same area. And there's a fair bit of noise because sometimes you're measuring to the top of a pebble, sometimes you're at the side of a pebble and such. But basically, you can see that there's no variation in the amplitude. So it must be maintained through time. And yet we know material is always moving downhill. So you've got to have, to maintain this, you have to have quite a bit of vertical motion in the subsurface. And in other words, I mean, for example, where you have a ridge, you have to have a scent of material to compensate for the what's moving on the surface. Same thing in the middle of the fine grain domains, you have to have this. And if you want to tie this all together, you have to have some kind of convection. Because, I mean, if you want to move material up this way, and then bring it down here, you've got to somehow connect these things. Okay, so this is a form of free convection that's induced by freezing and thawing. And of course, this is something that I've already shown here. I mean, this is the overview. And what I want to draw your attention to is that when we put all this together, all of the little bits of physics that I mentioned to you and a couple of other things that I will mention next, talented individuals like Mark Kessler and Brad Werner, who are modelers, are able to create models that produce that overall motion over time. And in this case, you can see there's an ascent of material here, motion to the side there, largely constrained here on the boundaries, and then also you have this location here where you have subsidence of material and then return flow. So let me talk to you about this model a little bit, what's in there, because it comes down to fairly simple physics. Mark Kessler is responsible for this, and he finished his PhD a couple of years ago. But basically, his model had the following ingredients in there, is that you allow material to freeze, and where it freezes, you form ice lenses. Where the ice lenses form, you're going to eject particles. So the stones move perpendicular to the isotherms. And also, there's a tendency to, because you're developing kind of a disjoining pressure along that isotherm, you're pushing material downward as well as upward. Okay? As you push material upward, in this particular model, it's very simple. You allow the material to come up to essentially an angle of repose, and then you let it sort of relax. So that's what the surface creep is. And there's also surface creep on this right here that's at a lower angle. And then there's feedback. Wherever you have lots of stones, you don't have as much latent heat, so you're able to actually have your freezing front propagate deeper, and that's what gives you the uneven sort of freezing front. And that's absolutely critical. If you don't have the feedback between texture and energy transfer or heat conduction, you have no way to actually have, you have no mechanism to form this pattern. So let me show you. This is an initial model showing essentially something that simulates a layer of fine grain material that's dark, and then coarse grain material that would be like the pebbles I've talked to you about. And let me show you what happens in Mark's model. And basically, I think that this right here represents like a few thousand sort of cycles or years. But I think it's remarkable that given the simplicity with which the physics is conveyed, you know, how nice these patterns are. And I think Mark Kessler was very talented, you know, in doing this. And I think that to me, the next step, I was talking to Lucas about this earlier today, is this is to me is an exciting way to actually probe, well, what are the essential elements that are needed to actually form this? And then we should be able to take this and say, let's go back to the field and ask more precise questions, and then let's take that back to the modeling and make the model closer to reality. So that's kind of the exciting place we're at on the modeling. I was involved with Brad Werner on earlier models. These are models just in two dimensions. This didn't really have a three dimension. And basically, what I want to draw your attention to is this is on a flat surface or horizontal surface, you develop this sort of model here. At least Brad Werner was able to develop this model. And these weird features that are not circles, but are more, you know, you have these weird sort of curvilinear path, are very similar to what we see in Spitsbergen in some areas. I mean, most of us are drawn to really nice circular things and stuff, so most of the pictures you'll see are the circles, but these forms here are quite common. They're much more irregular. And it's interesting that even simple models are able to provide that kind of work. Mark Kessler was also in the model that I showed you with a little animation, was able to show another type of behavior. He said, for example, the one that I showed you was like this one. But if you vary the concentration of stones, you can have quite a different pattern. As you change the concentration of stones and diminish it, slowly you'll get to islands of stones instead of circles of where the periphery are stones. Then this other simulation is interesting, is that these are basically a part of this domain, and so this is flat here, and then as you go in that direction, the inclination of the slope increases. So now you turn on gravity, and what you end up getting are stripes, like this. So you've broken the symmetry, and you're able to get this. And it's amazing to me that this pattern, I mean, this simple model, and with one more ingredient, which I don't really believe in, can get you also this interesting complexity. But the model is very, very rich and is able to give us a lot of insight. So let me talk to you a little bit about stripes. How much time do I have here? Almost? Okay. Okay. I'm kind of winding down anyway. But let me take you to Greenland now. This is a pattern that we're currently looking at, so our understanding is somewhat more limited. But I want to draw your attention to these sorts of features here that go across like this. And I'm sorry, this is not a very photogenic picture because it's got roads and stuff. But you can see there's kind of a elongation of the pattern here, and they diverge like this. So this is kind of a high spot that's pretty level. On the high spot that's pretty level, you notice that there are polygons that are much larger. Those are similar to the polygons that I showed you from the dry valleys in Antarctica. Those are ice wedge polygons.
This is a beach, right?
Actually, no. This is a crest of a ridge that probably has carbonate bedrock just below the surface. So it just has a thin veneer of soil. But the road here gives you the scale. A typical road like this would be like 4 or 5 meters across. So the stripes are, not quite about half of that. You know, like 2.5 to 3 meters. So these patterns here, they're elongated downslope, are more akin to the stone circles that I showed you, the scale with the active layer depth. These right here seem to be at a larger length scale, but arguably, and my close collaborator on this, Ron Sletten, would probably disagree with me, that if you look hard enough, you can find really small polygons that approach this in scale. But to me, this picture kind of tells you that they are two distinct length scales, okay, and two different dominant processes, with perhaps some overlap. So let me tell you about this pattern here a little bit more. this is what they look like, and Lucas is working on this now also, but what we find here is that we have these stripes that go down a very low slope. This is just a few degrees. And what marks these stripes is that they're fairly distinct troughs, and they're vegetated. We don't know why the vegetation is concentrated there. Maybe because there's better drainage, or maybe just out of the wind, so they're not fully exposed to the high winds in this area. But you get this really interesting sort of pattern like this, with kind of a secondary little feature right down there. We call these sort of phantom stripes. And then you can also see that the vegetation comes in almost periodically along these, suggesting that there is a segmentation of those stripes transverse to the direction. And so let me tell you, I mean, one of the things that we did at this site is, you know, you could see there were roads in the area. It's very close to an Air Force base, Thule Air Force Base. So we have access to big toys. And so we couldn't resist but have a trench cut across several of these stripes. Here's one of these stripes, another one coming across. So we dug a trench right down to the permafrost and went down about 60, 70 centimeters in this area. And one of the interesting things that we got out of this, and this is a picture taken out of Jennifer Harvard's thesis, is that there is a lot of interesting structure below the surface that's rarely apparent, because, I mean, it's hard to dig holes unless you have a big backhoe like this. And what is seen here is that in these troughs that are shown here, there is this sort of pink color that marks bodies of sand. So they're very similar to the sand wedges that we see in Antarctica. But also what I'd like to draw your attention to is that these pink bodies and the dark bodies like this are all fairly rich in organic material. So there's a lot of organic carbon that must ultimately come from the surface and largely localize in these areas, as I've shown you, that ends up, you know, down at depth and then forms these distinct pods of material. So this suggests that there's some complicated dynamics that doesn't involve mixing of the material, but that's actually moving material from top to bottom. And we're currently looking at this. I want to focus here on this little image on the microtopography. And this is across these stripes. You can see typically they're about 3 meters across, and you have these very conspicuous cusps. And here, just like in Spitsbergen, we suspect that the behavior is going to be largely diffusional. Material should move downhill. So if you look in a section across a slope, there should be a convergence of material in these troughs. And for them to remain deep like that and distinct like that, I mean, they must be dynamically maintained. Now, that's about all I can tell you at this point, because we don't know the rates at which any of this is occurring as we're just starting the study here. But the form is very suggestive. When you see this everywhere, you can assume that you've reached some kind of steady state. So these are not transient features, otherwise you'd see very different stages. And so you must have, they must be dynamically maintained and involve the descent and ascent of material, the descent in these areas and ascent in these areas that are maintained. And this vertical motion is very important here for one reason that's not the case in Antarctica. In Antarctica, we have no plants, essentially. Here, we find that all the organic material is occurring in these sites, and it's going down. So this is a very effective mechanism of actually burying material at depth. Okay? But in this day and age, especially given the news the last 2 or 3 days now that it's public that climate is actually warming, when one has to think about, you know, what happens now as we warm the Arctic as much as twice a global average, and this material, this carbon that was taken down to depth and frozen for a very long time, now we're going to warm that up, and then we can sort of release that back to the atmosphere. So it's going to be one of the important feedbacks as we warm the Arctic. So part of that story is understanding the rate at which you're taking that organic material, taking it down, and also bringing it back to the surface where it can oxidize very effectively. So this is an important part of this. And then also material must move downhill, and we think, based on other studies, that's going to be roughly about a centimeter a year. But we're just in the process of looking at this type of evolution. The final thing I will talk about are the smallest patterns that I will talk about. This is the stone stripes that form due to freezing on the diurnal basis. And so this is typical of the high tropical mountains. This happens to be near the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And here, you don't think about freezing, but it does freeze there almost every night. So you have more freeze-style cycles there than just about anywhere. Okay? And we think that in this area, the really important thing is that this is about 15 centimeters. You have fine-grained material with lots of ejecta from a recent volcano in here, so little pumice fragments and such on the side, and scoria. And but they're common elsewhere, not as well developed. This is in the Rockies, for example. And they tend to operate, the textures go down, the textural differentiation is about 10 centimeters or so. So about the same as it went. And the dominant processes on this is something that I haven't really talked about, and I don't have time to get into, but I'd be glad to discuss with any of you if you like. But basically, the formation of needle ice right at the surface, this is something you should be aware of. If you're walking around on frozen ground and it kind of feels crunchy underfoot, you're probably walking on needle ice. Again, it's ice that forms right below the surface, but often moves up pebbles. So in these areas, like on Mauna Kea, if you have a domain that's a little richer in fine-grained material, it retains a little more moisture. It will freeze there. It was more likely to form needle ice there. As it grows, the pebbles are moved up at the surface, and then, of course, they'll tumble as soon as you hit it with sunlight, and there will be a bias down slope. But it turns out that because the fine-grained domains also heave up, there is a tendency to move material downslope and also to the side. And so there's a very effective mechanism of moving the stones until they encounter other stone-rich domains. And so that's a very nice way of kind of having an accentuation of the sorting. And there's some very nice experiments that you can do here because it happens so quickly. And as I'm kind of winding down here, let me sort of share with you a quote from David Cavaniero, who I believe took this picture, because this is out of his book, and also wrote this, which I thought was really appropriate. And indeed, I mean, to think about how needle ice forms, I mean, I find it completely non-intuitive. I think we understand something about it, but actually fairly little. I mean, why shouldn't you just, if you're going to grow ice at the surface, why don't you just grow it at the surface and, you know, it should just dissipate over the surface? But why should it form here, this structure here, and just essentially exude out of the soil and displace the rock? So in conclusion, this is kind of a repeat of my outline with the blue as things that I'd like to just add, is that, you know, we have these two different sort of mechanisms. Here, the penetration depth of the seasonal cooling seems to be kind of what determines the link scale. Where you have ice induced here, you have frost heaving in the active layer, and then you have needle ice growth in this last sort of this last topic. And this occurs on a much smaller sort of link scale, you know, commensurate with a diurnal time scale for the propagation of a thermal disturbance. And I want to emphasize that the heaving and sorting of the soil is not associated with a 9% volumetric increase. In terms of insights, I hope all I can really perhaps bring to you that you may not have thought about is that there's a very strong link between texture, heat flow, and then the generation of these patterns. And then also that these patterns inherently, I mean, merit our attention, but also this convection that's due to freezing and such may actually be very important on a global scale, because it dictates a turnover rate at which we can deal with this subsurface organic carbon for an area that represents a tremendous storage of carbon relative to the current atmosphere. So I'll show you one more slide, and this is an example of a pattern that we don't understand at all. Okay, and in fact, I was hoping that Stephen might have some really good ideas, and actually has an idea that deals with colonial gophers. But since we don't know, then I can pretty well clearly tell you that it has nothing to do with geology. I mean, it's not. I can pretty much dismiss all the mechanisms. I was hoping that maybe it could be sort of seismic shaking or something. And the physicists have been very active in looking at various kinds of behavior. But these are features that are just in our backyard, and it's kind of an embarrassment that we don't have much of an idea. They're not subtle features. I mean, it's not like we're looking in the outer, you know, the outer part of our galaxy looking for some subtle effect. I mean, these are mounds that are like about from here to the wall there in terms of, you know, horizontal link scale, and about 2 or 3 meters high. And they cover entire prairies. And so they're very obvious, but the problem is they don't seem to be active now. So I'm a bit at a loss as to like what to observe, what to measure. But there are plenty of interesting ideas. I mean, one of them, from just an anecdote of somebody clearing their dog shed that had been covered with ash from Mount St. Helens back in 1980, saw that by hitting the roof, he actually got mounding of the surface that looked very much like this. And then there's been an idea that biologists like, that if you have gophers that for some reason like to gather in one area, maybe a high spot because it drains better, or maybe because there is a better Bernoulli effect of getting circulation, then the gophers are always burrowing out, so that means there's always radial convergence of material in, and when the burrows are all gone, then you end up with this mound. But I don't find it too compelling, except there is one bit of data that you might like to know about. Somebody had actually put magnets around these mounds. This is Gordon Cox. And going back with a little treasure finder, that the magnets had actually moved inward. So there was radial convergence at depth. So they may actually be the story. But this is just an illustration that there are many patterns, and some of which we're still at a bit of a loss. But thank you for your attention. No questions about gophers, please.
You mentioned several times in your talk at first about the relation between the vertical and horizontal length scales involved, but you studiously avoided saying anything about these kilometer halvings of Mars. Do you or any idea what
it's an excellent question. We can understand why, for example, on Earth, the seasonal sort of length scale gives you cracks that would go down to a certain depth, and also that you're releasing the stresses out to a distance that's essentially commensurate with that depth. So the next crack can't be too close. So we think that the connection there is the crack depth with the spacing of the polygons. So in order to explain the Mars patterns, you somehow have to get cracks to go much deeper. And that's very difficult to do, because even if you were to periodically change the temperature on a much longer time scale, the gradients, because of diffusion, decrease with depth. And so in a material that relaxes, if you don't stress it fast enough, basically the material would flow at depth rather than a crack. So you have to go to another mechanism, and there are many others. I mean, what I've focused on here is thermal contraction. But, for example, you could do this more structurally. Supposing you had a whole area that was doming up because inflation from, let's say, magma, the whole area would tend to be under isotropic tension and would tend to crack at the surface. So I tend to think it's, when you're looking at the really large features, you're looking at something, you know, that's quite different than this sort of surface-induced cracking. Nice question, though. Thank you. Yes?
Does the freezing expansion play a role in any kind of pattern development?
I think the only place that I can see that the 9% volumetric increase is important is supposing you have a rock that's completely saturated with water and you freeze it from all sides. Undeniably, you're going to have to expand. I mean, the water will have to expand if it's really sealed in there. So if you freeze that and do it fast enough so the water can't come out, then you'll pressurize it enough that you can fracture the rock. And the same thing happens actually for the formation of feature that you may or may not know about, but in the high Arctic, we can do this on a much larger scale. If you have a lake in the permafrost area, we know that there will be some sediment below the lake that will not be frozen if the lake is more than 2 meters deep or so, because the base of the water can't be below freezing if it's more than about a meter and a half or so, even in Alaska. And so there will be some unfrozen material. So now if that lake were to drain, then you freeze it, and it's surrounded by permafrost, so then you end up with a pocket of water that has to expand somehow. And when you do that, you generate high pressures, and eventually something fails, and you get the surface ice to buckle up to form a pingo. And that's how you get a closed system pingo. So those are two. So I didn't mean to say that it was not important, but it takes very special circumstances. And I happen to think that rocks also break due to freezing, not because of this expansion, but because of the same mechanism I talked about here. Water actually comes to freezing centers and forms ice lenses that very forcefully pry apart the rock. And it's like your crystallization pressure. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Size of the polygon. But if you were to look at sediment, like grain size,
I think this, what you mentioned about the low center and the high center initially brings to mind, you know, what controls not so much the size but the microtopography. And the microtopography has to be kind of this competition between processes that create relief and those that tend to smear out relief. Uh-huh. Oh, is that right? Well, that's no. I'd love to talk to you more about that. I mean, I've never really seen. I'd love to. I mean, I'm unaware of a correlation between the size and the morphology, but I can imagine that there would be some really rich interaction, and the size should certainly be somewhat dependent on the rheological properties of the material, and so it should be dependent on grain size and moisture, and so I'd love to talk to you more about this. Yeah, that's not something that I've run across.
Is it possible for convection to run this way as well? It's not crazy that some polygons may sink.
Yeah, I think we don't see much sign of convection on these polygons. I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I mean, especially like the pattern we're exploring in the Greenland now seems to be somewhere in between this contraction crack, and it has a lot of similarity with the patterns I showed in Spitsbergen, which do involve convection. So we have to sort out kind of the relative importance of those. But those could be, because one is very strongly dependent on this frost heaving, that's highly texturally dependent. I mean, frost heaving, you do not get frost heaving like in sand. You need to have lots of surface area, lots of unfrozen water that requires a lot of surface. In geology, looking at rocks, I mean, it's equivalent of having high surface area minerals like phyllosilicates that provide a very different sort of transport property. Than larger crystals. Yeah.
It's very rare that I come to a lecture with a question in mind and you actually hit on it.
Which one was it?
It was the needle ice.
Oh, I see.
And I wanted to ask you whether there is an association with underlying either soil types or geology that provides needle ice with its forming capabilities. The only place that I've noticed it in is in slate areas that happen to be in North Wales. And I was intrigued by this needle ice when I first saw it, and that's the only place I've seen it.
Uh-huh. No, it's a beautiful feature. I had a picture here that needle ice like forms also form on vegetation, like dead vegetation. I had these little fibers coming out. But going back to your question, I mean, I think needle ice, I mean, if you're not intrigued by needle ice, you're not looking at things carefully enough. I mean, because they're everywhere. I mean, when you look for it, I mean, this time of the year you won't see it, right? Everything is already frozen. But the time you'll see it here, like is in the fall or in the springtime, when the soil is warmed up. So you, in a way, you can't nucleate ice in the soil. So you nucleate ice on the surface just when you get to a clear night. So a beautiful afternoon, you know, when you have a clear sky, but it's going to freeze at night, is when you're going to see that needle ice. But going back to the requirements, once again, you need to have the pathway of water to the surface. And then as it freezes, there's got to be enough water that remains mobile between the ice and the substrate so that you can nourish the ice. So that requires high surface area. So you need to have silt or a little bit of clay. If you have too much clay, then the permeability is so low that water can't get there. So in terms of surface area, the clay would be fine, but it eventually seals off that transport of water. So you normally get it, you need to have the moisture too, right? So you need to be near a source of water or to have very moist soils, and it helps to have bare ground so that you're radiating out to space without any insulation. And it seems like the effect of stones is that they're like little heat fin that you locally cool, so that's you nucleate more readily underneath the stone than to the side or something like that. But that's not something that anybody has looked at quantitatively that I know of. But these are the ingredients. So you won't get it on sand.
Where's Roland? He should be here too.
I wonder, just have one question. That model you showed, the little movie of making the sort of circle, is that a continuum model or is that a discrete model?
No, it's a discrete model. It's a cellular automata model that has like three or four rules. And the rules don't pretend to be, sophisticated rules, but basically they represent the essence of what we think is going on. And as I say, I think there are like four rules. I can sympathize with all of them, and I think we can make them more precise. There's a fourth one that sort of comes out of convenience more than compelling evidence in the field, but I'm not. It may be there once we actually look for it.
So it sounds like we need a continuum model.
Yes, but I think it's really wonderful that, I see the patterns, I study the patterns, but I don't really know how they form. And with the model, we can say, look, if you think what goes on, is going on, then you can actually see, whether your suppositions actually make sense in a self-consistent way. So I think the models are very powerful. And once I see the model results, I want to go back and really remeasure things more precisely, or at least I have new questions that I wouldn't have asked without the model. So I wish, I'm glad that I can work with people who do the modeling. I'm kind of envious of doing it myself, but it requires, you need a young brain and young tools to address that.
Thank our speaker again.